Hello, Great Minds. It's more than likely actually Tuesday, and that means that sometimes it's time for Drinks with Great Minds in History, as we get ready to examine a darker side of the American Revolution, far darker than betrayal. We are looking at prison ships. So welcome to the show, everyone, as always. I'm your host, Mr. DGMH, otherwise known as Zach Tobacco, and today, in the final chaser of Season 4, The Chaser to Benedict Arnold, we chase our American Judas with a topic that has always piqued my interest. You know, when I first started writing about Benedict Arnold, even researching Benedict Arnold, I mean, I've always been fascinated by him, but I knew that it would raise a lot of questions. It always has. Many of them would go unanswered, or I would learn other answers to them. Maybe my answers will continue to change. I knew that he would take me down a few beaver holes or two if I let him. But what's really rare is I actually knew where I wanted to head for the chaser going into the episode. I normally make it up as I go along, but not this time. But what I didn't expect was to find a story that was pretty much the polar opposite of treason of Benedict Arnold's that one can find. A neat short story that allows me to tell a story of another forgotten patriot of the revolutionary drama, which if you haven't picked up is something I apparently like to do. And to do that, I am drinking another Brooklyn Brewing Pilsner, because you might be thinking, Jesus, he's getting really fucking lazy. That's three times in a row. Well, I like to use my boot glass. I gotta get my $13.98 value out of it. Either way, I'm also chasing it with a glass of Lazy River Bourbon, which I will rate later. And if you were thinking, wow, a repeat drink and a lazy straight bourbon, that's exactly what you did last time. Well, the name fits. And it's really the best I got for now. I'm heading to Hawaii in like 2 days, and there might be a storm coming, so I'm trying here. Either way, we are heading to the river, actually the bay in a more specific case, and that's why I'm drinking Lazy River Bourbon today. But you know, talked about all these big battles, all of Arnold's American victories, his betrayal. We talked about those that were defeated. We even talked about British people, British soldiers being taken prisoner. But what we didn't really talk about were those Americans, like the one soldier Arnold chatted with after his defection to the British side. Where did they go? What happened to them? You might think to yourself, Canada sounds like the easiest option. But that's a pretty cold and faraway place to transport prisoners of war. So it turns out the answer is prison ships, and that is what we're talking about today. And those will be prison ships controlled by the British, to be exact. And I will also tell you the story of someone who really showcases, again, the opposite of our great mind. Still heroic, but in a very different way, and certainly not a traitor. Plus, I'm going to answer a surprisingly relevant, I mean more and more relevant, question that has just gnawed at me since elementary school. But first, it's some history for you, a reason to drink for me. It's the history of the great minds that made history come to be. So today we're going to start off with a little discussion on art. Interestingly, it was the artist John Trumbull who famously painted all the well-known scenes of the Revolutionary period, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the surrender at Saratoga, featuring fucking Horatio Gates, either way, the surrender at Yorktown, portraits of Washington, Hamilton, and more that you have no doubt seen. Just Google John Trumbull and you'll see them all. But personally, I have always loved that scene in the HBO series when John Adams tells Trumbull off for his calm depiction of the 4th of July scene of the signing of the Declaration, something that Adams went on to describe as much more chaotic and haphazard, not everybody being together at the same time, if you know the painting I'm talking about. But Trumbull's works often capture the big names, great minds, and pivotal moments of the story. One could easily say or criticize that he did little to cover the truest, darkest, simplest, minor moments of the war. They could say that, but they'd be fucking wrong. You see, my favorite of his many works has always been a sketch that he did long before becoming one of the first great American artists, and it was a sketch of the conditions faced by Americans on British prison ships. Of course, I will share it all over social media, but this almost unfinished-looking pencil sketch beautifully captures the tragedy of war, the suffering of those on board these prison ships. But let's discuss what exactly a prison ship is, and I'm getting really sick of saying that word over and over again because it's surprisingly hard to say. But let's also talk about where they were first used and how they worked. So prison ships have been used, especially by the British, with their far-flung empire and tiny island state, really since the beginning of the Revolution. But not really for the purpose of holding Americans. Actually, the first ships were used in London, along their main River Thames, to handle the imprisoned surplus within the city limits. However, prison ships, more accurately called prison hulks, were the tragically perfect solution of how to deal with prisoners of war across Britain's growing, well, actually growing and simultaneously shrinking, empire. But you might be asking, what the fuck is a hulk? Well, a hulked ship is a ship that floats. And you might be thinking, no shit, Mr. DGMH, but that's not what I really mean here. It's a ship that floats but has no means of moving. The term could refer to a damaged ship, an incomplete ship, even a sailless ship that was tugged around for the sole purpose of holding prisoners of war. And that is what we saw in the American Revolution. One such ship is the HMS Jersey, which was built and launched in the 1730s. It actually saw naval action in the War of Jenkins Ear from the Bonnie Prince Charlie saga, as well as the Seven Years' War, before being converted first into a hospital ship in the Revolutionary period, and then, in 1780, finally converted into a prison ship. The ship was marooned in Wallabout Bay in New York City, what is today the Brooklyn Naval Yard. Brought to New York City sometime after the city's fall to the British during the Battle of Long Island. And at any given moment, there would be more than 1,000 prisoners held on board the Jersey. Survivors described heat so intense, prisoners being barely clothed, the sun beating on them all day when they were above deck, or being stuck in the halls below that were so tightly crammed. And of course, rodents, vermin, rats were common on board the ship, and one survivor noted that the, quote, sick were eaten up alive. Another noted that, quote, there was 8 died a day while he was there. Well, finally, another lamented, the air was so foul that at times a lamp could not be kept burning, by reason of which the bodies were not missed until they had been dead for 10 days. Prisoners often received spoiled food, and the ships were a perfect arena for disease to fester. But as the British situation worsened as the war progressed, so did the treatment of those on board the Jersey. Including the accounts I just read, a lot of the survivors' stories were collected and published in a work in the 1970s. But that's not all I want to talk about today. Still, British prison ships were used from Australia to America and everywhere that the Union Jack flag seemed to fly in between. They were used in wars from Napoleon to World War II, and even by the British as late as 2006. And they pretty much always just fucking sucked. But my brief examination of the Jersey led me down a beaver hole into a story of a one James Fortin, someone I had never heard of before doing this research. So James Fortin is one of those revolutionary badasses that never really stopped being a badass until he died. Born in 1766, he was a child of the Revolution. Born free in Philadelphia to Thomas and Margaret Fortin, yes, another Peggy, he and his family were active in the sailmaker's trade for generations. In fact, this was the trade that James's grandfather was in when he worked to free himself from slavery. That's right, James's grandfather was enslaved. Yet his grandson James would go on to die one of the richest businessmen and active philanthropist in Philadelphia by 1742. But let's not skip all of the stuff in the middle that really connects to today's topic. When James was 7, his father fell to his death in a tragic accident, and James began working to help provide for his family just 2 years later. He worked in the city while simultaneously attending Anthony Benezet's African school to educate persons of color in the North. Benezet, a Quaker, was truly a great mind, but not one for today. 2 years later, in a moment that I could only imagine was breathtaking, he witnessed the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence, a lifelong source of personal pride for him. And 5 years later, he joined the fleet of the Royal Lewis under the command of Stephen Decatur Sr., formally joining the fight against the British, at just age 14. But when the Royal Lewis was captured by the British, the crew was impressed. However, Captain John Beasley saw promise in Fortin, who offered to send him alongside his son to England to be formally educated, to which Fortin shot back, quote, I have been taken prisoner for the liberties of my country, and never will I prove a traitor to her interest. How very not Arnold of him. I mean, literally declaring for America and the Patriot cause, Fortin refused an easy out and decided to stay loyal to the Patriot effort. In declaring for America and the Patriot cause, Fortin was taken as a prisoner of war, possibly sparing him the fate of many captured Africans during the Revolutionary War who were sent to the Caribbean to be enslaved on British sugar plantations. James was then sent to the Jersey in New York City for the remainder of the war until being freed at the war's end. He then had to walk all the way home from New York City to Philadelphia, where he then made a career as a merchant and later sailmaker. His work would even take him to a London shipyard for more than a year. But in 1798, he purchased his own sail loft and made quite the business out of it. He was married twice, had several children, and was a lifelong abolitionist. He even signed the 1801 petition against the slave trade. At another point, he once wrote to the Pennsylvania legislature saying, quote, "Has God who made the white man and the black left any record declaring us a different species? Are we not sustained by the same power, supported by the same food, and should we not enjoy the same liberty?" His powerful words certainly make him seem like a powerful force in the early abolitionist movement, which he would continue to fight in till his death. But beyond petitioning his government, Fortin was also a patron of William Lord Garrison's periodical, The Liberator, until his death, persuading the author to actually write against recolonization to Africa, even writing for the periodical under a pseudonym, quote, "a colored man in Philadelphia." As I said, by the end of his life, he was one of the richest and most generous men in the city. He died at age 75 in 1842. As for the Jersey, well, when the British finally abandoned New York City in 1783, the horrific vessel was burned. Remnants of the ship were rediscovered during construction in the city in the 1980s. More than 20,000 men were said to have died during captivity and imprisonment on board British prison ships. More than 10,000 were said to have died on the Jersey alone. And that's five times the amount of men who died in battle for the American side. And this, of course, is the very condition captured in Trumbull's sketch: filth, disease, abuse, neglect, and sorrow. Of course, I feel that I would be doing a disservice to all of my listeners if I did not point out the reality that these conditions remind one of the tales that I've told of the Middle Passage, but I'd say to a much more mild degree, and are reminiscent of the very conditions that Fortin's ancestors would have faced while enslaved on board a slave ship. And on that note, I need a drink. So today I'm drinking some Lazy River Bourbon. It is around $40 per bottle, and, you know, it's like as good as Buffalo Trace, but a little more expensive. Actually, Buffalo Trace almost needs a re-rating on this show because the price has gone up significantly. Either way, Lazy River Bourbon is a fantastic one for you to try for this quick chaser rating. I would probably say I'd give it 4 points for price, 5 points for taste, and 4 points for returnability, giving it a 13 out of 18 points and a low end 5 crowns. Well, that's it. If you enjoyed this episode of Drinks with Great Minds in History on British prison ships and the story of James Fortin, then let me know on Twitter or Instagram at DGMHHistory or on the Drinks with Great Minds in History podcast Facebook group. And be sure to leave the show a great, hopefully 5-star review wherever you listen. If you enjoyed this episode, then we hope you'll consider supporting the show over on the DGMH Patreon page. There, listeners can get access to all sorts of bonus content available to supporters of all levels, from bonus Last Call chats from your favorite Psych and Shots episodes to extra moments with Mr. DGMH and Cullen, plus What I'm Teaching, Washington's Words, Cullen Chats China, Pete Chats Portugal, Another Moment with Mr. DGMH on the 30 Years' War, and so much pregame content now, where we chat history, catch up, and answer listener questions. So let's wrap this up. Prison ships represent the dark reality of war, far darker than Arnold's treachery. But Fortin's story represents another end of the revolution, the success of the revolution, the success of liberty and freedom and the pursuit of happiness for all Americans, and one that extends across the formation and entirety of the new republic. His was a story that showcased a great mind trying to navigate a racially divided America, fighting for freedom and abolition until his death in the decades preceding the Civil War. In all that, there has still been one very important thing that has been fucking eating away at me. Well, two or three things, actually. That is, the Peggys. In his life, Benedict Arnold married two women, both named Peggy. And our character for today, James Fortin, also married a Peggy. I'm sure there were countless Peggys. There was a Peggy in the Hamilton musical. But aside from the fact that Benedict Arnold clearly had a type, all I can ever seem to think about is how the fuck did we get from Margaret to Peggy? I mean, I don't get it. Margaret is the given name, and then we end up all the way down at fucking Peggy. It doesn't make any sense. It hasn't made sense since my lunch lady named Peggy in elementary school told me that her name was Margaret. It has always, always, always fucking driven me crazy. And so down the beaver hole we go. And it turns out it's kind of a lame, boring, simple answer. So Peggy is an example of some linguistic term called a diminutive. That is a shortened and typically informal form of a name. Keeping this to a diminutive, or a short explanation, well, short enough for me to do another shot of this delightful bourbon. A diminutive is basically the diminishing of a word or name from the original state. So apparently we go from Margaret, which apparently is Greek for pearl, to Maggie, and then Meggie, and then Meg, and then Peg, and then finally Peggy. Meaning that over time, people just kept changing nicknames, and as someone who was a big nickname person in their classroom, I totally get that. But I really thought it was going to be something more interesting. Either way, like Jack Kennedy or Hank Williams or King Chuck III, we have countless examples of this linguistic principle. Even Margaret and Peggy. Hell, even Benedict Arnold has its own surprising, albeit uncommon, diminutive in Ned. Either way, that's the story of how we get from Margaret to Peggy, plus a few other things. And that's really it. From James Jimbo Fortin and his time on the HMS Jersey, to Trumbull, who first captured my interest in British prison ships, to Peg, I guess this was as fitting a chaser to Ned Arnold as any. Cheers!